Hello, and welcome to our Punch Drunk Loves, a podcast celebrating the films we adore. I am your host, Neil Bolt. On our Punch Drunk Loves, I'm joined by a guest who brings a film they love so much it leaves them punch drunk. Our combined task is then to discuss why that love exists and to celebrate it. My guest on this episode is filmmaker, an artist, and technical advisor for Unnamed Footage Festival, Evan Jordan. Evan, thanks for being a guest on the show.
Hey, I'm glad to be here and to talk about a movie I love dearly. And I like the idea of this, of really just getting to know a person through a film they love. So that's cool.
Yeah. It's like there's plenty of other places and times to be shitting on things. So this is
the opposite. Yeah, no, that's great. That's great. I love that it's a positive angle you got here, you know?
You're good. And with a film like this, I think that's all the more necessary as well, I think, where it's given its divisiveness.
Yeah, there's probably plenty of negative negative stuff about this movie on the internet.
Something that seems to be a common theme, I think, with Harmony, but we will get to
definitely.
That.
Definitely.
But before we get to the film you brought today, I always ask a first-time guest a few general questions to get you to know your cinematic mood board. Though I feel I might have a bit of a clue with some of these. But probably not the first one. So the first question I always ask is, what's your first film memory?
Do we want to go, you want to go cinema or you want like in terms of being in the cinema itself or in terms of watching stuff at home?
Oh, you could do both if you want.
Okay. All right. So the first move, like memory I have of watching a movie in a theater, I had a birthday party when I was young and we watched the Pixar movie Monsters, Inc.
Wow.
And it was at this theater in Pensacola, Florida, called the Silver Screen, which shout out to the Silver Screen Theater if that's still open. I don't even know if it's still there or not. But it was a really cool, like, old theater that, like, you could get pizza and, you know, full meals and alcohol and stuff at while you watched the movie. And so we had, like, tables in the back and we had like pizza and everything while we watched Monsters, Inc. And I remember like that's I'll never forget that, you know?
Yeah, understandable. I mean, ironically, mine from a different era was Basil the Mouse Detective. So it's like mine was Disney-esque in some way as well.
Okay.
So it's Disney. It's always up there for kids, I think, at some point. Well, it used to be, I'd imagine. I mean, it's a one in two chance between that and DreamWorks sure. Now.
My kid is definitely into Disney stuff. So my youngest is a big like Pixar and Disney Animated Studios fan, like all the stuff they make, she's into. That's probably not the first movie I saw in a theater, but that just the experience really stands out to me, you know? And I think that's my strongest like early memory, you know, of watching stuff, because I don't actually know what the first movie I saw in theaters was. I don't remember.
Yeah, I with me, I think I just got told, yeah, that was the first time we did go with you. So the only
I'd have to, yeah, I'll have to ask my parents now. I'm curious.
Yeah, this is it.
But in terms of watching stuff at home, I mostly remember because I was born in 1994, so I was a child of the late 90s, and satellite TV was. Like in you know in its heyday.
Oh yeah, you had the best of all worlds going on.
Yeah, and so I remember most of my exposure to movies as a kid was through just watching stuff on TV with my dad or my grandpa, which so a lot of action movies, a lot of Western movies. And of course I watched kid stuff too, you know.
Yeah.
But basically VHS tapes, going to the video store and renting whatever looked cool from the shelf. That was kind of all of my early childhood memories of movies are all just stuff that looked interesting or stuff I caught secondhand, you know?
It's an unfortunate thing that isn't, you know, quite as doable these days, but
definitely.
Yeah, it is nice that it was ever a thing, yeah, that we had this sort of choice because, you know, before that generation there wasn't really a choice at all like that, so
right,
you know, just like rock up the theater, yeah, this sounds good, get that. I mean, that in itself is its own little mystery, I suppose, back then. But yeah, Now you kind of know everything before you know anything, sort of thing.
Yeah, now you know every single thing about a movie. Most of the time, people on the internet know if they like it or not before they even see it.
Yeah, yeah. Who knew? The internet will give us all precognition. Just not very good.
I wouldn't even say that there was one specific movie there as much as the form of intake, you know, that kind of spoke to how I watch movies now and how I engage with movies now. I'm kind of willing to give anything a chance, you know, like I'll watch anything, and I love stuff that's different, you know, or experimental or going against the grain, or, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that's the great thing about it. I think I had this conversation with someone the other day about music as well, and saying, you know, it's like, it's one of those things. I grew up with so many different tastes. My dad's taste and my mum's taste were so different. Then my uncle's taste were more metally and rocky, and they all sort of blended together. And, you know, I pretty much listened to everything and anything, you know, in that way.
Yeah. Sense.
Movies is pretty much the same, because again, different tastes from different directions from an early age just kind of just made it all like that. Just happened to fall into horror more than anything, I think, which is, an occupational hazard, I think, but
See, and that's interesting, because my horror renaissance happened later in life, like middle school, I would say, later childhood, you know. And I had it was all through video store there, and I had like a summer that where I was old enough to like ride my bike to the video store by myself, probably like seventh grade or so, and that summer, all I did was go into the video store. Their little mom and pop shop had like a 5 movies for 5 days for $5.
Aye.
On anything that wasn't a new release. And so I pretty much spent that entire summer just watching movies with my friends, like going back and forth to the video store on my bike. And
beautiful.
I watched all of it that summer, like Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, Halloween, Child's Play, any old horror stuff. I took it in. The Exorcist,
mainlined
all of
it. Yeah,
you know, yeah. I was about it, all of it. I didn't even care, like if it had a cool cover and a cool description on the back, I was in. You know,
that's it. It's all it takes. Yeah, I mean, I think I had a similar thing where it just an explosion of it at a certain time really just made it, and I think it was when, like, video rentals were closer to home, because it was like half an hour away to the nearest one, and yeah, this one around the corner was like, it had enough, you know. I think that was just like the early 2000s, so I was getting all the J horror stuff out, and having cultivated all this love of other things that, like, BBC had started showing a lot of the films that had been banned, you know, in the video nasties.
Yeah, video nasty stuff. Yeah.
So like, I remember like Mark Kermode putting a program on one of like Zombie Flesh Eaters and Dawn of the Dead, you know, which I
recorded
both. Yeah, and it was just like, my dad wouldn't let me stay up to watch it, but like I was so excited because I was into zombies and at this time, and like it was like this monumental event to sort of get and watch those at that time and tape them off the telly. And
absolutely. Well, and the beautiful Romero zombie trilogy is like some of the best films, like, you know, out there, I think.
I mean, I've only on a podcast, I think I've only ever talked about Day of the Dead, which, you know, just made my love for that film like grow.
Yeah,
you
know, I like that one. I feel like people don't talk about that one enough.
Yeah, you know? I mean, like, it's just like
two get talked about a lot, but the third one does not as much.
Yeah, I mean, and it's given it's more of the template than for what it should be like than anything, because it just feels probably the one that's aged the best in terms of like storyline. Because the characters are the way they are and the way they interact. And
yeah, and I think it really taps into humanity the most, you know, in terms of like in a way that the other two don't.
Yes.
You know, because the way they're isolated with the, you know, you've seen.
Yeah. A few times. Yeah, there you go. See, there's tangents already we're going on, but it's fine.
I'm sure that'll happen a lot here.
I'm sure it will. So let's move on to the next one, which is our favorite genre.
You know, I guess I would say horror. Because I that's what I watch the most of. You know, I watch a lot of like reality stuff and documentary stuff as well. And obviously working with Unnamed Footage Festival, I'm really into any kind of in-world camera films.
Yeah.
Although we kind of consider it more of a format than a genre, really, because they can be any genre. You know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, by the list you've got on Letterboxd, of those, your favorites. And it's like,
oh, yeah.
I mean, the things I found off that, like, how different they are, whilst yet they can all still tap into horror in their own little way, which I think sure. just comes from the format in general, which I'm sure we'll get into when we talk properly. But yeah, it is proof positive that, you know, there are so many different ways to go with that.
For sure. Yeah. And a lot of stuff that, you know, like people talk about Paranormal Activity and like the main, you know, like the main Blair Witch and like the main found footage movies, but there's a lot of stuff out there that is so different from those movies that doesn't really, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Blair Witch just happened to be a case of it came out at the time it did.
It was a phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, and
I wish I would have been not 4 years old.
I know. I mean, I was a teenager, had the internet, and that was a thing. And you know, like that was part of my own VHS rotation for so long because it was just
that's so cool. Everything.
So yeah, that's always been like the starter pack in there. I think even when you do see these different changes and different styles you can do with it, I think that film has a lot of elements to it that spread out elsewhere.
Oh, for sure.
In those films.
One of the most influential ones ever made, you know?
Yeah, that's it. And it goes so much more beyond just the horror aspect. I think it's the use of cameras. Especially when it comes to things that are documenting an event, and that's what they're doing, sort of thing.
It created the term found footage, because I mean the opening card of this is their footage. You know, before that there was, people didn't call it found footage. It was like mockumentary, or that was the closest word you had to describing films shot this way. And it kind of was one of the first of its kind too. So found footage work. You know, because most of the mockumentary stuff leaned comedic before that.
Yes, absolutely. So yeah, I suppose that's like your subgenre, if we're going for it, then would be that's, I mean, as you say, bedfellows that they are. Yeah, it makes sense. Favorite actors? And I always say actors because it's one is always difficult enough, you know.
No, 100%. I really love super like naturalistic stuff. So I'm a big fan of Mark Duplass.
Yeah. Good shot.
Because I just believe him when he portrays him. I'm always like that. He is that guy, you know, like he just always nails it. And I love naturalistic performances and kind of in that vein. I love, John Carroll Lynch, the guy from Zodiac who plays.
Oh yeah.
Arthur Lee Allen. He's a great like kind of character actor. He always pops up in super interesting roles. I'm trying to think. Actors are this one caught me off guard more than the rest, I would say.
Yeah, there you go. It's a common habit, I think, with a podcast so far. One question at least one question will catch people.
I'm a big fan of a fellow who he hasn't done a ton of stuff, but everything he's done, I love. Vinnie Curran is his name.
Yeah.
And he's in four films directed by Aaron Moorhead and Justin Benson, who are a couple of my favorite directors. And he's the friend named Chris in Resolution, the addict friend, if you've ever seen that movie.
I don't think I have.
Yeah. He's a doctor in Something in the Dirt, their newest film. He's a side character in Spring, and he comes back as Chris again in The Endless.
I think I know the one you mean now. Yeah, when you say that, the film I'd seen him when you said the name.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was The Endless. Yeah. I'd seen him in, yeah.
The Endless. Fine. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So the character he plays in that is the same character he plays in Resolution, because those movies are connected.
Yeah.
But he actually was just in an in-world camera film that we showed at UF last year. So I got to finally meet him and talk to him about how much I liked all his stuff in Benson and Moorhead's movies. And because as a, like, I had a period of my life, and we'll get deeper into this once we get into Trash Humpers, where I went through a phase of terrible addiction, and that's what Resolution's about. So it was, it was very meaningful to get to tell him, you know, how great his performance is of portraying an addict in that movie. Cause I feel like that's something so many movies get wrong.
I think it really does kind of require the experience somewhat, you know, to like many things, I think, acting can do so much, but I think when you get into specifics like that, it's a tough one to do unless you've got some sort of background in it yourself.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, that movie he was in that we showed was called Everybody Dies by the End. A very funny and intense high stakes horror comedy that is on Tubi. So if people want to, and Screenbox, so if people want to watch it.
There you go. Yeah, I just saw that on the list. I'll see if I can find that over here. You never know with this country. You may find it, you may not.
That's true, yeah. We have totally different catalogs on a lot of stuff.
So. Yeah, well, over here, it's, I think, because there are two places that have a monopoly on a lot of things, so it's a shrug if they get released, you know, or if they show up on certain services. But on a slight side note, like the last three spin-offs of Walking Dead series, like none of them have turned up on British TV yet, which is like, I don't.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because Disney had carried the last lot of the main series and then nothing since then. So I have no idea what's going on with that. But it, you can have emissions as big as that. So that
wow. Yeah.
I know we left the EU.
Something indie making it over there is. The odds are probably lower, you know?
Yeah. I mean, Prime's Video is actually probably the best one for that. And
you can always just rent it, you know? Yeah. Mod. And it's worth it. Support small filmmakers for sure.
Exactly. So we round it out with favorite directors.
Okay, so this one I can definitely dive into. I do feel like that there's probably actors I probably didn't hit, but it's okay. That's gonna happen. I would say favorite directors. I mean, obviously. One of my favorite is Harmony Korine. I've consumed everything the guy's ever made multiple times. I think the way he looks at movies and the way I look at movies are similar in terms of like how we put them together or how we just kind of view them, you know? And I also, like I said before, I'm a big fan of Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead. All of their films are kind of a sci-fi horror. And all of them are really time-centric, which I think is something that I find myself thinking about a lot and that I find so fascinating and simultaneously in a positive and a negative way, you know? Because time is... it's great in some ways and terrible in others. And they explore that in a very interesting ways that I like.
And yet make it feel so much bigger.
Right. Exactly. Moment. Yeah. It expands the scope while also making it feel so that's a good way. Yeah. They tell intimate yet massive stories.
Yeah. Which is like, as an aside, it feels kind of like the opposite. I felt about like Villeneuve's Dune where I felt, it's like, it feels cosmic, but it's actually, on another level, just felt really shallow to me. It's like I couldn't quite marry the two things the way I wanted. It is like the flip side of that, I think, with what they do. It is impressive to be able to do that on a small scale.
For sure.
I mean, I've seen a few in the last few years, I think, in film-wise, where you see small-scale films really embracing what they are and going back to that trying every trick in the book to make it feel like it's not cheap, which has been hard.
Right.
I think, with the Dawn of CG, the use of it has been a bit flagrant and sloppy, to say the least. So when you do find places that use it the right way, it's hard to avoid it, but it's just makes it all that more special. It's that thing.
Yeah, did you see their movie Synchronic?
I haven't yet. No, that's on my list. So
that one does some insane shit with visual effects, and it does it in a way that, I don't know, feels really like not only like realistic, I guess, in the way they apply the fantastical stuff, but also just looks really good and feels integral to the story in a way that I think is cool. It doesn't feel tacked on just to look cool, you know?
Yeah, which is like, if you can make it feel like a natural part, definitely. Or even like, you know, tap into the absurdity of the cheapness of something.
And
I've seen things go, I mean,
absolutely.
Like, I don't know if you've seen the film Hundreds of Beavers.
I haven't.
I mean, it somehow, you know, on a bugger all budget, it evokes like classic Looney Tunes style cartoon in live action.
Okay.
By being cheap as fuck. But it's just funny. I don't know. I think it's the Lake Michigan Monster, if you've seen that.
Oh, I have seen that. I love
that. It's the same guys, basically.
Oh, then I'm sure I'll love it. Yeah. Yeah. They have a real knack for like parodying or satirizing like very specific types of movies. I'll have to check that one out. I didn't realize that was the same people, but Lake Michigan Monster is great. I got the Arrow release of that.
That's a grand one as well. But yeah, I found that ridiculously good at what it did in that way of just making the most of the small budget. Anyway, again,
and aside, I think that's one of the things too that you know, Emerald Camera stuff is good at. And I think one of the directors I really like, who's kind of just had one smash hit and has another one that I've seen it and it will be a smash hit, is Robbie Banfitch, who made The Outwaters. People are really, that's another really polarizing film, but it's like came out of nowhere and is a huge success, and I think deservedly so. I think he's one to watch, especially in the Emerald Camera space, because to come out with a debut like that, and then his sophomore feature that's still in the editing bay that we showed at an early cut of it, Unnamed Footage, last year, is called Tinsman Road.
Oh yeah,
and it's totally tonally different, and shot on mini DV, and really a whole different vibe than The Outwaters, but also fantastic. So I think he's really one to watch. And he's instantly became one of my favorites working in that space. And then like I mentioned Mark Duplass before too. And I think I love the mumblecore kind of understated drama films. Again, anything really naturalistic. And I think all the directors I've named have that in common. That no matter how big their stories are, everything feels, or bizarre, even in Harmony's case.
Yeah.
But it still feels gritty or grounded in a way where, you know, it's natural.
I mean, I think we won't say it right now, but, you know, watched that Vice documentary from last year with him, like that. And the way he described Trash Humpers, you know, when we get into it was...
The epically latered episode that he's on.
Huh? Yeah. And that was fascinating, just the way he explained it. It's like, that makes total sense now. But as I said, we'll get into that when we
do. Yeah, I love that starts out. He's just hanging out with that guy smoking. He's always smoking a cigar, but he's just in the street with this like conspiracy theorist, like skateboarder. Like, I'm like, this is the most Harmony shit I've ever seen.
Yeah, and the way he looks at him is like, you know it as well. That's understandable of him, I think. But I think that brings us nicely into the film itself then, doesn't it?
It does, I think, yeah.
Yeah, which is, as we said, Harmony Green's Trash Humpers from 2009. The film follows a small group of elderly peeping Toms through the shadows and margins of an unfamiliar world. It is crudely documented by the participants themselves. We follow the debased and shocking actions, the likes of which have never been seen before. Green directs and stars along Brian Kotzer, Travis Nicholson, and Harmony's wife, Rachel Green. It's a found footage film, as we've probably alluded to a bit here, and while it initially leans into the lewd, crude home video style nonsense of skate videos, it begins to dig into a rich vein of unsettling horror that's right at home in this particular subgenre, I'd say. You know, I was excited about this pick for three reasons. One, because I thought this would be my introduction to Harmony Korine's work. It wasn't. I'd seen Kids when I was younger, so yeah.
Okay,
I mean, that again, when I talk about those films on getting viewed on the BBC that were controversial and all this stuff,
Yeah, that's from surely one of them, huh?
Yeah, that was one of them, and I remember watching it. Yeah, that was a film. Yeah, and it was interesting the way it went, but then to see half the cast now.
Yeah, he was still young when he wrote that, too.
I was going to get into it later, but yeah, I went to the sort of rabbit hole of like the Letterman stuff where he was on Letterman.
Oh, yeah, the Letterman appearances, where he eventually got banned for allegedly digging through Meryl Streep's purse.
Oh, man. Brilliant. Two, it's the first film on this podcast I hadn't previously seen. And three, the fact that this movie is so damn divisive fascinated me as well. And, I think even when you really enjoy something, you can see why a film is divisive. Like,
Sure. Like, somebody could tell me this is like the most meaningless, vile shit they've ever seen. And I'm like, yeah, mm-hmm. Okay. Like, I can see why you feel that way, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this is it, isn't it? There are so many films, I think, where you kind of think people might be being contrary in opinions, like things like Beloved, and someone comes out and goes, well, actually, it doesn't do this, or it does this specific thing that pisses me off, sort of thing. But it sounds more like a you problem, but you do you, sort of thing.
Right.
But yeah, it's rare you get films where it's just like, yeah, I understand everything from a 1 to a 10 with this one. It makes sense.
Yeah, and he kind of always has that kind of across his body of work. He makes stuff for him and like what he wants to make, and like,
yeah,
he doesn't cater to what he thinks somebody wants out of him. If anything, he would do the opposite, I think, of what he thought somebody wanted from him. But I think that's like, I really connect with just how he has such a unique, singular vision for his stuff, and he just makes it. And it's, I don't know, people love to pick things apart and add meaning to them that he's done, but he almost never elaborates on what something actually means, which I think makes the works all that more meaningful, because they're left to be dissected like art should, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it does allow you to sort of pull your own thoughts on it and think about what it reminds you of, what it does right and does wrong to you. And, you know, one of the things I was going to bring up that we were just talking about before was in that Vice documentary, where he basically talks about it being, it's a skate video without the skating. You know, it's all the dumb shit in between. It's like, yeah, that makes more sense. I mean, in a way that's more pure and offbeat than like, you know, what Jackass is as a phenomenon, you know, which is like, it did eventually become everything but the skating on a massive scale. Yeah, that became the Looney Tunes version of that, whereas this kind of regresses and gets warped with time, I suppose would be the best way of putting it.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Yeah, they kind of, Jackass and those sort of, which I love, like, I could go down a whole rabbit hole about Jackass, because I'm a massive Jackass fan, too.
Yeah.
But they definitely lean more into the, especially with, like, Knoxville at the helm, it makes sense. They lean more into the Buster Keaton, you know, like.
Yes.
Let's do like extreme physical shit, as you know, like, yes. Let's hurt ourselves and it'll be funny. And if there's a skateboard on screen, it's usually used for something like that, and not just joking. Yeah, but I do really love skate videos too, and maybe that's part of why I like the aesthetic. There's one that called Yeah Right from the 90s that Girls and Chocolate Skateboards.
I've probably seen that, thinking about it, because
I think it's Ty Evans and Spike Jones who directed it.
I hung out with a lot of skaters during the late 90s, I think, going to college and that. And so it sort of became like part of my lifestyle without me ever being part of it, you know, sort of thing. So yeah, I think
it's got some it's my favorite skate video ever. And it's got some truly amazing bits. There's like the invisible boards where they green screen the boards out, and the and Owen Wilson comes in it. There's an Owen Wilson scene in it. And there's a scene where they throw there's like a magic skateboard that rolls from screen to screen, and they'll pick it up and like toss it, and it flies out of frame and then somebody else will catch it in another frame. Like, it's just the editing and the music and everything about that skate video is perfect. I think it's like one of the most perfect skate videos ever made. So good.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that coming from that sort of world, you know, which, you know, Harmony did, you know, it was part of the genesis of Kids as well.
Right. I mean, yeah, that's the people he hung out with, you know, yeah. Skaters in New York and stuff.
That's it. And looking at that and how, you know, just basically filming your hobby to sort of show off what you could do, it feels almost like it should naturally evolve into like, yeah, what if we try doing this and that and this? And then before you know it, you've rolled out down a hill to something completely different. And all of a sudden, yeah, and it's kind of, yeah, this film kind of feels like that journey in its own way, where it's the idea of like going from just doing a skate video to just like, yeah, but now what about the bits? And like, it's like the bits have been like copied and pasted and, like I said, warped and melted over each other in this film, and just till it becomes something else entirely.
Yeah, 100%. And I don't think, especially with Trash Humbers, if you look at the kind of the arc of Harmony's life after, because he, and if you watched the Letterman appearances too, so you saw how each time, and he kind of by that last video is super like spaced out acting, and yeah, like he's, you know, and so he had a dark, there's a few years where kind of like people don't really know what the fuck he was doing or where he was. He says that he was mowing yards. That's what I've watched a lot of interviews, and he's like, what, they're like, what were you doing during this time? And during that time in his life, he did a podcast appearance with a guy named Kaveh Zahidi. I'm sure I butchered that pronunciation, but they talk about their careers. He's a filmmaker as well. And yeah, and so he brings up that time in Harmony's life where he's kind of unaccounted for. And he says, what were you doing during this time? And he said, well, mostly I just was into mowing yards. And and so did he actually mow yards for money and like lived a like kind of strung out existence for a while, or did he make that up? Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty, isn't it?
Which yeah, you really never know when he's speaking if what he's saying is total bullshit or if like it's something that's true.
Yeah, he does seem to have that air about it. I mean, I think I've seen the things saying, you know, he's just genuinely like that. You know, he's genuine. He's not awkward. It's just the way he is, sort of things. Like, and then
right,
you look at some of those appearances, like on Letterman, and it's like, yeah, is it just that though? It's like, it's like, so the way there's almost a punchline to stuff that's like not a traditional punchline in the way he says things, and like, yeah, it's a bit, yeah. If I were to sort of compare it, it's almost like Andy Kaufman-esque. Right, you're not quite sure.
I can see that. Yeah.
You know, not sure which part of the person is there and who it is and if they are.
Right. That's a great way of, yeah, I've never really thought of it like that, but that's a great way of looking at it. It is very Andy Kaufman-esque. Yeah.
Yeah. Which,
and it's kind of like you don't really know if it's, is he doing it on purpose? Like, is it performance art? Is he just fucking around, you know? Or like, that's, I don't know. And I think that makes him way more interesting. And I think he knows that makes him way more interesting too. So I feel like he's leaned into that persona once he realized people kind of ate it up, you know?
Yeah. I go back to that Vice documentary again, and like where he's showing his paintings and the whole thing about the yachts with the dirty names, you know, sort of thing.
And just, oh, like, yeah.
The way he looks around each time is like, Yeah, you get something without ever. It's like, it's such a shit eating grin on his face. So I love it.
Yeah, and all of that's like post, like he's sober now.
Yeah.
You know? So, like, cause that's my theory with Trash Humpers is like, I spent over a year of my life addicted to methamphetamine. And yeah, this was probably 12. What is it, 2024? Yeah, we're talking like 12 or 13 years ago now. I eventually, obviously, I'm not an addict anymore, and I like have a family and stuff now, but I kicked it all to the curb myself, and I enjoy watching films that I think are either that directly are, or that I think are about addiction. And this is one that I think I view it as an allegory for addiction. There's a lot of reasons why I think that. And obviously he's never going to confirm if that's what the movie is or not. And maybe it's not even that to him. But that's how I feel about it.
Yeah. I mean, for him, it could have just manifested from that, you know, quite easily without him even realizing it, which is
right. And that's why I brought up, you know, the time it came out was like right after, cause he, the first film he made after he got sober was Mr. Lonely, but that was an idea I think that he kicked around for a while. It felt to me like Trash Humpers was his first, like maybe he had written that movie or even subconsciously, like you said, that was coming through, you know, in what he was making.
Yeah.
Cause I mean, think we do that with art, especially artists who use their art to deal with stuff that's going on in their mind, you know?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's some do it over and over again. And, it's like therapy might be cheaper, guys. You know, if you want to get or rehab, one of those things. But probably not as lucrative, I'd imagine. But at the same time, you understand that can be the way that people want to deal with that and want to get that out, you know, like that. And he strikes me as someone that like can look at it and just like, yep, I did that. I was stupid. I was dumb, but I don't care. But I do sort of thing. It's yeah. It just, again, just revolves back round into this persona he's built where it's you're never quite sure of the sincere parts.
And, right.
Which is, I mean, you touch there about that with addiction. And one of the things it made me think of was like those sort of nights, end of nights out, you know, in my 20s, you know, like then there was like lots of drinking going on and lots of, and there was lots of smoking and stuff like that was always going. And there was a guy. There's a guy in our group that was like, you know, he was getting bad. You know, he couldn't handle drugs at all, and it was like he ended up having like a psychotic break eventually after, because he just wasn't the kind of person that was really meant to be dealing with all that, because of the group he hung around with. It just felt like odd and horrible that it went like that, and just the mood and atmosphere of certain nights. And the way it could turn, it felt very reminiscent at times in Trash Humpers of that, you know, where it was uncomfortable.
Things can shift on a dime, you know? Mm. And I think that their behavior, like I've watched this thing so many times that I've like gotten to the point where I watch like the little things they do and like,
yeah.
And obviously I've got this theory in my mind now that that's what I think it's about. So obviously I'm trying to find, like I'm clinging to things I see that I'm like, oh, that's, but I, you know, like the only thing that the characters have in their life is really the other people who share these same bizarre bad habits, which is how it becomes once you've been using drugs for a while. You only like, you burn all your bridges, except for the other people who are doing it with you.
And then it all feels almost normal. Yeah.
And they're kind of, yeah, exactly. It becomes a way of life, you know? That you kind of stop caring about anything but the habit, which is I think these characters feel so dangerous because they don't display any concern for anything other than their own debauchery and their own, you know, fixations, which is kind of the world you get sucked into when you become addicted to a substance. You kind of stop caring about anything but doing that, you know?
It's embracing a disastrous side, you know, and embracing the destructive nature of it, which, you know, when I thought of comparison films, one that came to mind was Lars von Trier's The Idiots, which much about...
I've not seen that.
Well, yeah, in typical Lars von Trier fashion, it's something pressing buttons by a bunch of people who go around pretending to be mentally challenged, basically, and using that as an excuse to get away with whatever they want. And on the surface, that sounds like the most Farrelly Brothers kind of shit ever. But
no, I definitely could see, you know, don't know. That's an interesting. I'm already you've sold me just on that. I don't even. Like, I get why some people might attach a negative connotation to that, but I'm like in. You know.
Yeah, I mean, that was like 98. So I mean, and very, you know, handheld, grainy footage in the way they do it as well. So it kind of feels like, again, it was another one of those things where it felt like that. It felt like you're almost watching along with someone's, you know,
like a Dogma kind of thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was like the first, his first.
Was it one of those? Was it one of those? Yeah, because Harmony, Julian Donkey Boy is a Dogma film.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. So, like I said, this being the first thing. So yeah, the other films have all sort of come into my watch list now.
Yeah, that one's a really great as well, and it's a Dogma film, but it kind of breaks. There's a few Dogma rules it breaks, but I guess they liked it enough they just let him break.
Yeah.
I don't know. Because, you know, they were real, like, weird and stern about how those rules, like, if you didn't follow them, you couldn't get in. It was like an elite kind of, you know, but they let that one in, so.
Yeah, that's it. So, you know, going back to that, the idiots, the thing in there is, like, they don't glorify this detestable behavior, either of the cast. It's, like, it's very much an observing of the behavior in all its forms. It's, like, in the same way that, you know, Trash Humpers has that, where you are watching and you get curious about what they're doing, and in a car crash kind of way. But occasionally they just ramp it up to a thing where you go, oh, fuck's sake, come on. Like, it's a bit much of a thing like that. And that's straight away was like, yeah, that really gets to it. I mean, I think the difference here is, like, there is no deviation from that train of thought, no falsity to it. I suppose you, in The Idiots, it's very much case, you know, their beliefs of it kind of unravel as the film goes on. But here it is very much like a steadfast, no, this is the people we are, nothing's going to change sort of thing. Which, again, you know, when you talk about the addiction angle, that makes perfect sense too, because, you know,
they kind of see themselves as normal at the end. And everybody else as the strangers, especially in how he gives that speech at the end about, you know what I'm talking about. He's in the car and the camera's focused on him, and he's talking about, we don't go to church on Sunday and we don't play no games on Monday. And I suspect, you know, I'll catch my second wind. And, like, he's, you know, really, like, he's talking about how they fully, like, believe everything they do to be right and normal and perfectly okay, even though it's questionable in a lot of ways, say the least. And I think that's kind of a thing. That's a thing I fell into with my addiction at a certain point, is especially in terms of, like, such a specific example as being awake for a week at a time, and you think you're acting normal and you're not. You know, you go to a store and you're like, why are these people looking at me? Well, because you're being weird. And you kind of, you think of yourself as normal. You fall into this weird daze where you, you think everybody else is the weird one. And there's just a lot of little things too. Like the guy, he's standing in the corner telling these stories that, like, almost certainly never happened. It just sounds like made up shit that he's saying. And he's like, I mean, I've experienced that. Like, I've been in a room where that happened, you know, with, like, people who are just sitting around doing, I mean, we were doing drugs. We weren't humping stuff and the same, I don't know, just the same scenarios. There's some of these scenarios that feel so similar to things that I actually experienced while I was an addict, you know, and they seem to not show, like, value for human life, you know.
And I think it goes back to what I was thinking with like, remember my teens and 20s, where you have those dark moments happen nights out, you know, not always in the same person. Like, you go, I remember one time we a bunch of us, like, got the same flat together, like, lived together for a bit. And it was a very short-lived thing because everyone was a flake and it just didn't work out. But we lived with this one guy we didn't know, who seemed there, cool, calm, fine. But he went fucking nuts on Nights Out. You know, like he just like he would start spouting off all manner of shit, and it was like it was disturbing. And then knowing you had to go back and live in the same house as him, it was like, yeah, not fun either. But the amount of times I can remember people like that at the end of Nights Out that have been full of drink and drugs and stuff, and it's just like every night you ever do that, you regret it, obviously, the morning after. But Christ, yeah, it's like nowadays I can look back and go, I genuinely wish I'd never wasted so much time doing some of these things, because it's like you don't remember half the good things because they're stupid, you know, really, when you think about them, and irrelevant almost in what they are. But yeah, in the moment when you're like that, oh yeah, it's fine. It's let's do stuff like that. I think one of the things that other things, you know, not so much dark, but in the sort of chatting shit sort of vibe, that where stuff sounds really profound, obviously, if you're high or drunk or whatever, it's like, you know, the if we didn't have a head speech, you know, because it encapsulates something about a certain mindset where, you know, something utterly dumb is just said chest out profound way that you almost see the logic in it in the moment. It's such a random yet fascinatingly,
it's implied that I think he does. I don't know for sure, but I think he's the other one of them's dead, you know?
Yeah.
And even that I feel like is like when I got sober, like you kind of almost feel your conjoined twin come back. Like you feel the old you come back, but when you become an addict, you almost lose yourself a bit. And, That was a weird, I don't know, I just caught that this last rewatch. I was like, wow, the conjoined twins being separated really like made me feel like, you know, how you kind of lose your old self when you become an addict, and then you do the things like the chest puffed out and give profound speeches that like pretty much mean nothing.
I spoke on this with a director recently, like about America and like finding these pockets of, you know, pocket worlds almost in America itself because of the sheer size of the country. Even in a single town, you got places that just feel alien to one another. And, you know, with this film, these fiends like feel an example of how they move in a nomadic fashion, stumbling upon these other weirdos in their own little pocket worlds like that.
That
was something I found really to be so true about it, because here you don't really have that as much because it's all, you know, everything's like within walking distance, really, sort of thing of what you need, because we're not that size of country. But yeah, when I think of that in America, where you can just live an entirely different life from someone else and not even have the same culture and be like streets apart.
I live in Mississippi, for example.
Yeah.
And like I work, the Unnamed Footage Festival that I work with is in San Francisco. So when I go out there every year for the festival, it's a totally different world than I live in from day to day. You know, so it's, and that's just a full day's plane ride, you know? And, so, like you said, it's even more, it can be even narrowed down even more than that to like, there's places here that feel in the state of Mississippi that feel different than where I live or, you know, and especially I think the way they seem to find these oddball people living on the fringes of society in this movie, sort of, especially living in the rural South, it like that's very much feels so real, like that those people exist, they're here, you know? And so I think that makes the movie, you know, maybe this is a weird word to use for it, but it makes it almost endearing in a way.
Yeah. Cause it does feel like, I suppose, Americana, if you will, in a true sense, because you're getting a proper, truthful view of what it's like in a way. It just seems absurd when you think about the film in general, but those moments are the most real thing about them, because again, you can tell are these actors or people or whatever. They just seem so normal. I think when you were talking earlier about like just these natural performances and things, it's like, this is a film that's just constantly like that, you know, and found footage has to kind of have an aspect of that to work.
Definitely. Yeah, you have to believe what you're seeing, you know, in a way.
And in the people, and believe that they are the people they say they are doing the things they're doing. And yet you have these central characters who are obviously so very out of that world and doing their own thing that they kind of work for what they are. But
definitely.
And it's grounded by having those people around who are just as weird in their own little ways, but feel so much more normal. Yeah, you know, I think because we've seen people like this here, there, and everywhere in our lives.
Yeah, definitely. And there's just so many little things like that that every time I come back and watch this movie, I feel like I attach myself to something new, or I find something new or a new detail that I'm like, oh yeah, I like that. And I think that that's something that I feel like happens with all of his work for me. There's enough substance there to explore that I find new things every time.
Even like in the week or so since watching it, it's like I keep thinking of different things about it, and like it stews in your brain in that way. There's different ways to view it. As you say, you've watched it multiple times, and even with that, you know, idea of what you think it can be, you know, you can still pick out things that are, you know, beyond that idea, you know, and like those little details and little things that make you go, oh, okay, this is interesting. And this, yeah, it's why I like discussing films in this way, is because you can talk to someone else and really sort of extrapolate what you're thinking and feeling and learn more about the film than you ever realized by having, you know, this discussion and really just pushing it out there and seeing something a bit bigger about it.
Yeah, definitely. It kind of, and that's one of the things too, especially with Trash Humpers, I would say even more so than any of his other work, it is left more open to that. Like,
yeah,
what, you know, you could tell me this movie meant something completely different to you, and I would be like, yeah, okay. Like there's so many things you could get from it, and so many things you could apply to it, in terms of meaning. And I really like, those sort of films, that kind of allow the kind of discussion like we're having. Cause there's so many films, especially nowadays, it feels like they're pretty cut and dry. There's not a lot to really break down about them, you know?
Yeah. A simplicity, I think.
Right.
Well, where it's like, even when it's complicated, the bare bones of it is simple. And it's very much a case of you like this film because you like that person in it, or that the franchise or whatever it is, or you didn't because they don't like those people, sort of thing.
Like, I think that's why I gravitate towards independent films more, because they kind of tend to, since they don't have to be evergreen, not everybody has to like them. They don't need to make $1 billion to make their money back. You know, like they can kind of make movies very specific and very open and very different than like a studio film can be made, you know?
I mean, I think it even like applies to smaller films that get some sort of, you know, fame now.
Yeah.
Like, even they are talked about in the terms of like, oh, it, you know, I've written it enough times to know this, that, you know, oh, it had a budget of like this many thousands and it made, you write it because that's what people like to hear, unfortunately, about films. It's like, how much money did it make? How much of a success is it?
Right.
Rather than discuss, you know, why the film was good or why it was successful like that. I mean, sometimes it's just because it was good on TikTok or something. You know, it can be as simple as that. I mean, I look at that with saying like, the difference, I would say, between Terrifier 2 and Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey, where both are like low budget, both were kind of marketed the same way, but one had like this whole license thing that obviously has kicked off this whole thing of like kids things as horror again.
Right. And,
you know, but one is a genuine love of a certain kind of cinema and works in Terrifier 2. Whereas, you know, Winnie the Pooh thing is like, yeah, you can say it made a lot of money for what it was and, you know, just had a small budget and it meant that they make a sequel that's going to be more expensive to make and it will look great. But yeah, it was a terrible film. Yeah, there's no doubt about
that. I haven't seen it, but I kind of don't know if I will. I feel like it probably.
Yeah, it feels it. You know, I see it straight. You can see through films like that because it's like you had a film, and then you had an idea after the film that you sort of retrofitted into it. You know, so it's a film that was clearly a slasher film, and they added the Winnie the Pooh stuff by having the masks on top, and that was it. And
yeah.
Fine, yeah, and we're low budget, it worked for that enough, and you know, you don't really take a big hit, I suppose, if you get viral enough to make like that, and shown by the amount of people doing that now, I suppose, in that space. But yeah, I think it is nice when you can have those films that don't really rely on critical praise and what the financial success is, and left it in trash cans to be found, you know, sort of thing. Yeah, that would have been the perfect way.
Yeah, it feels like something that you truly could have just found under a bridge somewhere, you know?
Yeah, which makes it, to me, is like the found footage in the truest sense, because it's documented as like a manifesto by these people. They want this to be found.
Right.
This is the giving out flyers in VHS form, effectively, of like, this is our belief system, and this is the way we think the world should be. You know, that end speech you were talking about is, you know, kind of drives that home, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And there's a zine that comes if you buy the DVD of Trash Humpers, which there's actually a beautiful new release coming up from Umbrella Entertainment.
Yeah, it's still a report on it.
Blu-ray, and the first time it's on Blu-ray, which I don't know how much I don't know how much quality that Blu-ray is going to net you on this one, yeah. but there's probably bonuses that wouldn't fit on the DVD, maybe, but. But the DVD that I have, it has a zine in the front of it that has photos and different ramblings from Harmony and things. And there's a director's statement in there on Trash Humpers that I think is really interesting. And maybe it's Harmony doing his performance art thing, or maybe it's true. Who knows? But this is what he says about Trash Humpers himself. He said, "I remember when I was a child, there was a small group of elderly people who would hang out in the back alleys and under bridges by my house. They always seemed to be getting drunk and dancing. One night I looked out my bedroom window and saw a group of them humping trash cans and laughing. It sounded like they were speaking a strange invented language." This is a movie about them. Did he see these people out his window? I don't know. Maybe he didn't. Maybe he made that shit up.
Yeah.
But maybe he did.
This is it. And you know what's fascinating there is I'm sure I've heard him tell that two different ways now as well.
Like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, which, you know, if it was a memory when you're young, yeah, fair enough. You may change the details slightly, but it's like that playful, slight change in the storytelling that makes it go, yeah, okay, I get it. Like, I think the original version I'd heard of that was basically didn't even include the trash humping stuff. That was like the film that came later, but
yeah.
So that there is the interesting.
There's so many variations to it, you know, to the story, like there is with any story that gets passed around or that gets, you know, told about. It changes, and I think that's, even though it's all coming from him, he kind of, I don't know. The guy's an enigma, and I love that. Like he creates an almost air of mystery around himself by doing these things, you know?
And not in the way that normally happens as well. It's just
right.
Again, when we go back to the naturalized performance, it is almost that you can't tell. Yeah, you know, is this a real person? Is this someone, a character in a movie sort of thing? He's living it, you know, the whole thing.
Yeah,
it's no surprise that the film feels random and abrasive in its structure, because it's almost reflective of what he feels like, you know, like that. Again, going back to feeling personal about this film, you know, it does have that sort of, you know, feeling of like documenting a certain feeling and vibe of his life in so many ways from what I've seen. And it's just that, again, just adds so many layers to it. Yeah, for something that, you know, if you watch the first 20 minutes, you'd be like, what the fuck am I watching? You know, generally, it's, I think most people would have that reaction.
Oh, definitely.
And after that, where you come out of it, the other side, I think, can just split so many ways. But that's the beauty of it. I think it could lose people before that, just as easily.
Yeah, there's people who have made it 10 minutes in and turned this off, for sure.
Yeah.
Countless people. but yeah, it's always interesting to see what I love showing people this movie just to see what side of the fence they fall on. And I think there seems to be a trend. I have a handful of movies that I show to people to see what they, I like showing to people to see what, you know, which side they fall on. And I think that's part of why I like divisive movies, because they do give you that talking point, that stuff that is just generally well liked, you can sit there and have a, oh yeah, that's great and that's great festival. But
yeah,
the interesting conversations happen with the films, I think, that you feel differently than somebody else about, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, the title of this podcast comes from obviously the Paul Thomas Anderson movie.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I love that film.
Yeah. And, but I remember like showing that to that group I was talking about earlier, like back then, like that. Most 90% of that group was just the worst group to have for that, because they had no appreciation of that kind of film.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I can see why. But it was like, then there was like this really like this guy I would never have expected to, he would be the first person I'd think, oh, fuck this, this is wanky shit, sort of thing like that.
Right.
And he was the only one after it to go, yeah, I quite like that. It was interesting, like that.
Wow. Okay.
It's like
sometimes people surprise you, you know.
Yeah, and that's lovely. That was like, I think the first time of really sharing a film with other people and just seeing like the full rainbow of like from everything from disinterest to disgust to, you know, generally liking it. So that was, yeah, and having that in a film is fascinating. When you love something and you know that people are going to be like that, it is kind of freeing. So that,
yes,
it's fine if they don't like it.
Yeah, and I wish more people would be willing to sit down and give something a chance. Like I said earlier, most, like a lot of, in modern times, people decide if they like stuff before it's even out, you know?
Yeah, well, based on like one idea of like, I don't like that kind of film because I saw this one film one time.
Right.
Which I think this genre especially, I think, gets a lot of that. But you were talking about like The Outwaters earlier, and it's like, I re-looked at the score on like Letterboxd as being 2.4, and I was like, yeah, I don't love it. I think it's good, but 2.4 just feels odd. Yeah, it's like, and most of the negatives about it say the same sort of things that make me go, yeah, okay, I get why you don't like it, but your reasoning feels a bit iffy. Yeah, you know, it feels like very much stuck in the found footage to me is this one thing, and if it's not like that, blah, 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 sort of thing. I don't
definitely like
that. You know, that's where it gets stale. You know, when you feel like that. Same with Skinner Inc. You know, it was like, it's an old film, strangeness going on. I fell asleep during it, but I appreciate it. Yeah, because it was comforting.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's kind of got that nostalgia. That, yeah. Like, you know.
That was it. And it was just the wrong thing to be watching at night for the lights out, because I just felt cozy. I went to sleep. I hate that, because I don't like missing films like that. But
yeah, I think my favorite thing about The Outwaters was just how it does cosmic horror in a way that I like, that is cosmic horror, where they don't, like, because I feel like modern cosmic horror has gotten to the point where we're just like, tentacles, make it cosmic horror.
Yeah, I've had this discussion so many times. Actually, I was talking to Dennis Powley, who obviously did Reanimator, things like that, did Suitable Flesh with Joe Lynch recently as well. And you know, obviously he's done Lovecraft and studied that work, because he like does that. You know, he's a teacher of that as well. Yeah, I was talking to him about that, saying, you know, like, you know, what is it you've got to get right about Lovecraft and cosmic horror that you don't see in so many movies? And it's the feeling, it's the idea of what it is, not specifics. You can't get into specifics, because that's when you lose the point of it. You know, you are.
Yeah, and I love that. Like Outwaters, just kind of. I've seen that movie several times. I even saw a couple early cuts, and like I have no idea what the fuck was in that desert. I have no idea what killed those people, and I think that's why it's great, because it shows you glimpses of what's happening, but you never fully grasp what's even happened to these people, which is like it's incomprehensible. Which is, that's cosmic horror, beyond our comprehension. You know?
Yeah, I mean, like that goes back to what the Blair Witch Project did so well. I think it is just so vague and so, it could be real, could be fake sort of thing, because you don't see anything. And it's like, obviously that got ruined with later films because they show everything. And yeah, even in any adaptation, in video games and things like that, it's like, that's the problem with them. They've ruined it by showing you things constantly. It's like, no, you're missing the point. You need to, you know, it's about the ambiguity. And I suppose video games generally aren't always the best medium for that, if you're looking to sell a game, like
it needs to be like fun, but also, you know, like, so it's weird the way games, I think the way you have to look at those is definitely different.
Yeah. I mean, one of the interesting things I do on a podcast for Bloody Disgusting, it's called Safe Room, is, yeah, we do a weekly thing on like these games you find on Itch.io.
I love Itch. There's so much cool shit on there. So, yeah. So many cool, and a lot of cool found footage games.
Yeah. And that's what I was going to say. It's like the amount of games that we found that done that, you know, and done it well and really got the idea of what found footage can do and what it should do, you know, rather than just using the cameras and, you know, an aesthetic for the, yeah. I always think of Outlast being a game where it's just like,
yeah,
you didn't need the camera really. You're like, it's just, it feels a bit gimmicky to have it.
They made it your light source sort of.
Yeah.
And it really could have just been a flashlight.
That's it. And so, you know, it's great to see that in the small space, seeing different experimentations, like literal found footage, like as a bunch of games called the Lancaster Leaks.
Yeah, Lancaster Leaks is a good one. I actually did we have a found footage zine, and I did an article, me and my my friend Madeline, who's the director of Unnamed Footage Festival.
Yeah.
We have a zine called Footage Fiends, and my article in the first issue is about found footage used in games and the different
ways
it's implemented. And there's even games that maybe they don't fully use it, but like I talk about the Manhunt series in there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the format makes it feel like you're watching a snuff tape with everything you're playing out.
Yeah, no surprise. I love that too. So,
So I talk about all those different kinds of ways that they use, you know, the format in games, and I find that fascinating. I'm really interested in game design and stuff as well. So I like discussing those sort of things.
Yeah, I think like one of my favorite examples of that in recent times was Dan McGrath's Incident at Grove Lake.
I haven't played that one yet. I have it downloaded.
For anyone at home, that's like an alien abduction account, basically. So it has stuff that isn't found footage, and it has found footage in it. But yeah, it's just fantastic. You know, the mixing of it, where it feels so 90s, you know, it captures a bit of what the X-Files and Fire in the Sky did, and uses actual like conspiracy radio from back in the day as well as part of the radio station that's in there. It's great. One of the great examples, I think, of it in that medium.
Yeah, I got to play that. I got to fire that up.
Oh, yes. Definitely do.
There's so many ways that I think in-world camera hasn't been explored yet and still can be. You know, like, I think it's just such a bottomless format. Like, you could do so many things with it in terms of movies, games, even literature, you know, like novels and things because there's epistolary fiction and stuff like that where it's all written firsthand or like journal entries, and there's just so many ways that I think the format has yet to be explored. That's and that excites me to see what people are going to do with it in the future. And I'm trying to do stuff with it myself, you know. I made a short that played a couple festivals last year, and I'm gearing up to shoot a feature this year. So
nice. I envy you on that one. That sounds cool, I must say, because that's that especially as a filmmaking genre would just be like the best thing to do, I think, because just having a mythos behind it in itself in making it, just to me, it seems like a really cool thing.
Yeah, definitely. I'm really excited. We're going to shoot Murky here in Mississippi, and I've written a story that's very much like my short film, The Inverts, very political in its themes, but dives into sort of a cosmic horror, folk horror,
mystery,
sort of world, yeah. And it's all kicked off by me finding a cassette tape with something strange and bizarre on it.
It's happening to the right vein here. I'll say that it's that's grand. But, I like that.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to getting that going. I've got my friend Madeline I mentioned before on board as a producer, and we're about to start talking with some other people.
Awesome.
So hopefully we will be rolling with that by mid to late summer is the plan.
Fantastic. I think that's a good place to leave the conversation on. This has been great talking about this. I've really enjoyed it. You know, again, especially because it's been a film I had no knowledge of going in. You know, I've gone down a fresh rabbit hole with all this now as well. So yeah that's always appreciated. Yeah. And like beyond this film as well, yeah, it was the stuff you had on your list as well, which were just some really fantastic examples.
Yeah, I saw you had logged a couple things off of there, and I was excited by the stuff you watched. I love the Dirties.
Dirties, yeah. That was just like that was ridiculously good. And you know, Exhibit A, just wow. Yeah,
Matt Johnson, the guy who did the Dirties, his new movie Blackberry was pretty big.
I keep seeing it. We were talking about Amazon earlier, like in Prime Video.
I enjoy Blackberry quite a bit. I think he's another very interesting filmmaker. He's got another Emerald Camera one, Operation Avalanche. That's great. But yeah, I love that guy.
Yeah, I saw that again. Yeah, it was another one I saw on the list. I was like, yep, I got that. That's on my watch list as well. Because space, NASA,
space moon stuff. Landing. Like, come on, you know, you gotta.
Yeah, I mean, NASA and space stuff is another like one of my lovely, cool little things I like to watch films about. Yeah, so that was like, yeah, that's gonna be on there definitely.
We showed Trash Humpers at this year's Unnamed Footage Festival on 35mm, and I think that's like I can't think of a like that's my greatest accomplishment with the film festival is getting to watch Trash Humpers on 35mm, because I chased this for a while to try to line it up and make it happen, and
you got the opportunity to, why not, you know, that's it,
right? And to see one of my favorite films, you know, in you know, on film like that, I love Harmony Korine. Go check out all of his stuff, definitely, because it's all got that same kind of spirit to it, you know?
Definitely, yeah. And I would say those additional pieces, like those Letterman footage and the Vice interview, from very different points in his life as well. I think it's just like nice extra bit of context, isn't it? I think
100%. There's also an episode there's a German show called Into the Night. I think it's German. Maybe it's French. It's a French show, Into the Night. There's an episode with Harmony Korine and Gaspar Noé Gaspar comes to Nashville for the premiere of Trash Humpers at the Belcourt Theater. Who interestingly is still who handles the film print for Trash Humpers. The Belcourt Theater. He brings him to Nashville, and he takes him around Nashville similarly to Trash Humpers, where he takes him to meet these very fringe society people and people that he knows around Nashville, and takes him. They go at one point to a junkyard, and they play with walkers like elderly people would use, and like it's just this weird little adventure through Nashville, Tennessee, with Harmony Korine and Gaspar Noé, and it's a great watch as well. That adds some cool personal context to it, you know.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating itself with Noé involved as well.
So, yeah, definitely. And it makes sense that they're friends.
Yeah, that's, doesn't it? I said this the other day when I was watching the Hideo Kojima documentary, and like all the people involved, and like the people, the film people he likes, it's like, it makes sense that you're friends with all these people now more.
I want to see that. I gotta watch that.
It is very much a fluff piece as like for what it is, but it does solidify that all the people he works with, like in movie with kind of have an independent basis, you know.
Yeah,
like that, you know, when you saw sort of like Léa Seydoux just point that out today about like the difference between working in America and Europe, and like being more of a free spirit because of that, and it's like, yeah, all these things just make sense because, yeah, I think they appreciate how he approaches things. He's very much like an indie thing, so yeah, just on a bigger scale. You know, so I like that, seeing like-minded types come together like that, and especially when you don't really think at first, oh, Yeah, actually, no, they would make sense to go.
And right.
But yeah, that's a cool thing to hear. Before we go, is there anything you want to sort of shout out for yourself here?
I did recently start a podcast with my friend Kelly McNeely. Who works with Black Fond Distro and has written for countless horror publications. We started an action movie podcast called Click Click Punch Kick, and it's on all major podcast services. Episode 3 just came out, and that one was about Bruce Willis, and in honor of his birthday month. We talked about the first 4 Die Hard films, and we mentioned 5. And then, yeah, and then we got into a few other singular films from his storied action career, and obviously we kind of called it a part one because there's so much Bruce Willis that you could bust into. But and then our first episode we kind of covered our favorite action films. The second one was in honor of Black History Month, we did an exploration of some blaxploitation films from the 70s. And sort of explored that genre and talked about the history of it. But I'm really having a lot of fun with that. I like I said early in the show, action films is one of the things that I was exposed to from an early age. And have always kind of been a fan of since that's what I grew up seeing a lot. And so it's been fun so far exploring that with somebody who is equally interested and passionate about these things. And
always the best teaming for a podcast is having that like-minded appeal with things.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Our upcoming episode is a 420 episode where we're going to indulge in some party favors while we discuss some very specific action comedy films that spoof certain things.
Okay.
And yeah, I think we've got an interesting thing going, so you can check that out. I've probably said way too much about it already. I'm rambling.
Hey, we're in the right podcast for it.
Yeah, you can check that out on wherever you get your podcasts. And Void Video, another podcast I do, will be returning later this year. And that's more of a general movie podcast. So we'll have to get you on one of these.
Yes, please do. I love talking.
Yeah, I do too. I love talking. That's one of my
like not things. Not in real life, but yeah, in podcasts, fine.
But Neil, I appreciate you having me on here. This was a blast. I'm glad I got to talk about Trash Humpers, and I'm glad that when I first suggested let's watch Trash Humpers, I was like, for a podcast, is this the greatest idea? Because what if he hates it? But then maybe it would still be okay. So,
I mean, that's the thing. It's like, point is, it's not even really about what I think. You know, it's about my guest and what they love about it. It's like, so even if I'd hated the absolute shit, I would still have, you know, been looking for the positives.
Yeah, no, but I'm glad that you seem to like it as well. So that I was relieved when I saw you log it and it wasn't like a half a star, you know?
Yeah. I was like, yeah, I'm a sucker for ambition that is just abrasive. So it's an easy win for me. When we talk about like Gaspar, it's like, yeah,
oh, absolutely.
The climax, for instance, like, I fucking love climax. So yeah, anything that's rankles is interesting for me. Whether I like it or not. In this case, I did. So it's good. So.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm glad you did. And I appreciate you having me on here to talk about it and letting me dissect my very specific theory about this movie that I love bringing up to people who have seen it. So
there you go. Always appreciate it. And then yeah, I'm sure we'll have you on again at some point as well for a different film.
Hey, I would love it. I would love it.
Fantastic. So that's it for this episode of Punch Drunk Love. So we will be back with another guest and another film soon. Until then, go show your Punch Drunk Love for your favorite film.